And joining us today on Perspectives is Dr. Nigel Hamilton. Dr. Hamilton is an historian, and he is the author of various biographies, President John F. Kennedy's, various books on General Monty Montgomery, President Bill Clinton, and the recent book that we're going to discuss today is Commander-in-Chief, FDR's Battle with Churchill, 1943. And actually, this is, I believe, part two of another book that you wrote before this, and that was The Mantle of Command, I believe. Is that what it was called?
Yes, it's part two of a trilogy, really, FDR at War.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us here today, and we appreciate you taking the time.
I'm delighted to be with you.
Now, tell us a little bit about yourself, Nigel. Have you always been interested in history?
I studied history at Cambridge University in England, and particularly I've been interested in military history. My father was a very young infantry battalion commander at D-Day, age 25. Difficult to believe, certainly when I think of what I was doing at age 25. And through my father, who became a newspaper editor in England, I got to know Field Marshal Bernard Montgomery, who commanded the D-Day armies, the American, British, and Canadian armies at D-Day. So I've not only been interested in terms of written history, but I have a very personal interest in it.
And what I understand also is that you were the last person, besides family, I guess, to stay at Prime Minister Churchill's home.
Yes, it's pretty extraordinary to think when I look back. I was 19 years old and a student at college, and Field Marshal Montgomery, whom I'd gotten to know quite well, called me up at my digs and said he was going to spend the weekend at Chartwell in Kent, where Churchill lived, and he wanted me to go with him for the weekend to stay with Winston and Lady Churchill. And I said, Field Marshal, I think I've got a tennis match that weekend. He said, rubbish, be on the 2:30 train and I'll meet you. And if I'm not at the station, you'll walk to my house. So I think I did have to walk, and he took me to Chartwell, and I spent a pretty memorable weekend, during which Monty, sitting on Churchill's left at dinner, accused me of being a socialist, and Winston Churchill, who was just spearing his next forkful of roast venison, sort of thought about it and then turned to me and went, grrr.
And then what happened after that?
Very much the Lion of England, yeah.
And there have been a lot of stories written and books, documentaries about the Prime Minister and the Lion, as you mentioned. And some are kind of like, wow, is that really him? And then, of course, there are other people who say, well, he was a very difficult man to deal with. And, of course, George Patton, in some of his books, they talk about how he and General Montgomery did not see eye to eye. But I think General Patton had a hard time with other people as well.
Sure. Well, Churchill was an outsized figure, diminutive in size. He was only about 5'6", but just with an extraordinary mind, incredible wit, and a huge imagination, very impetuous, an inspirational figure. And certainly one could say if there was one man who saved Britain in 1940 and thus in a way humanity, it would have to be Winston Churchill. But as a historian, I have to say that he had very grave failings. He was not willing to be patient, which in its way was inspiring, but it meant that in terms of strategy, he kept making poor judgments and causing really needless casualties because he imagined himself still to be on the northwest frontier and able to do anything he put his hand to. And he didn't realize in World War II that the sheer ruthless professionalism of the German Wehrmacht, the German army, similar to the Japanese in the Pacific, meant that there was no easy way to beat the Germans in battle. And Churchill, on the one hand, feared casualties that would inevitably be suffered in a D-Day invasion. Nevertheless, wildly imagined that by attacking around the periphery of occupied Europe in World War II, he could somehow defeat Hitler and the Nazis. And it just wasn't possible. And for that reason, I felt that this second volume of my biography of FDR as Commander-in-Chief, would have to concentrate on that year, 1943, when Churchill very nearly lost World War II for the Allies. Churchill's obstinacy and his refusal to go ahead with the agreed D-Day invasion plan was potentially calamitous in terms of winning World War II in Europe, and, you know, with pretty incalculable consequences for so many millions of people, including millions of Jews and Gypsies, refuseniks. You know, 2 million Jews had been liquidated, as they said, by the Germans by the end of 1942. So when the president had to deal with Churchill in 1943, and Churchill kept trying to abandon or sabotage preparations for D-Day, the president came very close to losing his temper. And in some ways, it marked the end of what had been a very affectionate relationship from the time that Winston Churchill came over to Washington after Pearl Harbor. The two men had got on very well at the White House, and the president thought Winston was a real character and one of the most extraordinary people I think he'd ever met in his life. But by 1943, Churchill's obstinacy, I mean, people, even Churchill's chief of staff, British chief of staff, called it madness. Churchill's obstinacy in refusing to go ahead with the D-Day invasion preparations really became too much for the president. And that is the burden of my second book.
We're visiting with award-winning historian Nigel Hamilton, the second book in the trilogy, The Mantle of Command, and this is FDR's Battle with Churchill, 1943. You mentioned the fact that D-Day was put in jeopardy and very much could have turned things around had it not worked out the way it did. And before we talk about the Prime Minister, tell us a little bit about the president and also his relationship and what he did with his generals, because they wanted to kind of go ahead and do things before everything was ready.
Exactly, yes. The president had never worn uniform, but he had been Assistant Secretary of the Navy, the U.S. Navy in World War I. And after the Japanese attack at Pearl Harbor and Hitler's declaration of war, he took guidance from his chiefs of staff, his joint chiefs of staff, and they were all gung-ho for a D-Day invasion in 1942. And the president said, wait a minute, you know, we've never fired a shot in anger, and most of our army really draftees, then they're hardly even trained. We need experience. So I tried to show in the first volume, The Mantle of Command, how he made sure that the United States forces not only ramped up their arms, their munitions, their ships, their naval vessels, but that huge training schemes should be launched before American troops were asked to actually to go into battle. And now in this new volume, and that first volume ended with the United States invasion of North Africa and Algeria and Morocco, the torch invasion, which his own chiefs of staff were dead against and tried, in fact, to stop. The United States Secretary of War took a bet with the President of the United States that it would be a fiasco. Well, it wasn't a fiasco. It was a tremendous boon to the Allies, and especially to the people in occupied Europe, that the Americans were actually coming to Europe, or to the periphery of Europe in North Africa. So Volume 2 starts with the president going out to North Africa to visit his commanders and his troops on the battlefield. In fact, he was the first president in history to fly, took a flying boat to North Africa, and the first president to visit American troops on the battlefield abroad. And it was in Casablanca the president announced his absolute decision to follow a policy of unconditional surrender of the German and the Japanese. There would be no negotiation. This was a war to end that kind of military conquest, and he hoped to set up a new framework for the world of using the United Nations as the gathering of sovereign nations. And he overruled his generals again and said, no, we cannot do this. We cannot launch a D-Day invasion in 1943 because we need the experience which generals like Patton and Eisenhower will get in North Africa. And they will have a great advantage because there in North Africa, they will be at the very furthest extremity of German forces, experienced German forces under generals like Rommel. There they will learn how to defeat the Wehrmacht. And it's pretty extraordinary to think the general went out there in January of 1943, and only like 3 weeks later in February, his American forces did indeed suffer a terrible reverse at the Battle of Kasserine. But in a sense, it didn't matter. It didn't upset the whole course of the war. And he was able to see just how quickly his commanders, some of whom had to be fired, but just how quickly American forces, both commanders and troops, rallied and began to learn the lessons of modern warfare against a highly indoctrinated, professional, and ruthless enemy. And he hoped, when he sat down with Churchill in Casablanca, that these two leaders would cooperate between their forces, British Commonwealth forces and American forces, so that in the Mediterranean they could learn the business of modern war and then launch D-Day in overwhelming strength in the spring of 1944. And to his dismay, Winston Churchill agreed with this at Casablanca, but within a couple of months was back, this time in Washington, coming over on an ocean liner with hundreds of staffers and advisors to try and persuade the President of the United States to abandon his military strategy, to give up the notion of D-Day. So FDR had a terrible time with Winston Churchill, who really was very naughty. In fact, while he was in Washington in May of 1943, Churchill went behind the president's back and went and spoke to the senior members of Congress, senators and congressmen, to try and persuade them not to back their own president, which was really unconscionable. But in many ways, Winston Churchill was a law unto himself. Anyway, the president put down that revolt, so it's pretty extraordinary. And of course, all this was pretty much covered up after the war. It's extraordinary to think that only a few months after that, Churchill came to North America yet again on an ocean liner, the Queen Mary, with even more hundreds of staff officers and advisors, again to try and persuade the President of the United States to abandon his strategy of D-Day in the spring of 1944. And that time, the president really did get very curt with the prime minister, and he made sure the prime minister came to Hyde Park in New York, sat him down and said, now, Winston, stop it. If you don't follow my strategy, this step-by-step methodical approach, I will not agree to share the development of the secret weapon, the atomic bomb, with you British. Not only that, I've lost faith in you, Winston, and I have decided that the commander of the D-Day invasion will no longer be a Briton. He is going to be an American. So it's quite a dramatic story, and it is amazing to think that although something of this is known in terms of the chiefs of staff and so forth, nobody has ever told this story from the perspective of Franklin Delano Roosevelt as commander-in-chief of the armed forces of the United States in World War II. And after all, you know, we're living in a moment when we have to decide on a new commander-in-chief. So these are quite important historical lessons, I think.
We're visiting with New York Times bestselling author, award-winning author, and historian Nigel Hamilton. He is the author of the second book of a trilogy, Commander-in-Chief, FDR's Battle with Churchill, 1943. As you mentioned, Nigel, because of the president's untimely death, we never got to see any memoirs or anything. There are a lot of books written about FDR, but no memoirs. So did you get the opportunity to perhaps collect some of these papers, or did the family contact you, or you just decided to do this on your own?
It was my decision to do it. I had written a book called American Caesars about the last 12 presidents, sort of modeled on a famous Roman, epic Roman history, the 12 Caesars. And it was when I was writing the chapter on FDR, the first of our American Caesars, when America became, to all intents and purposes, a modern empire. It was when I was writing that first chapter that I realized there just wasn't a biography of FDR as commander-in-chief from his perspective, the way he directed the war, the way he directed his military. So I set about doing it. I began interviewing members of the Roosevelt family, going to the FDR library, but also I was able, fortunately, to interview the last surviving member of FDR's map room, and that was on the first floor of the White House, and that was where FDR set up his kind of military headquarters. All his signals to Stalin, to Eisenhower, to Churchill came and went out from the White House map room. All his highest intelligence, ultra intelligence, all came into the map room. So it was a tremendous privilege to meet last surviving member, Commander Elsey, who actually in 1944, he was right in the map room right at the very start, just shortly after Pearl Harbor. And in 1944, FDR called him in and said, "You're an educated man. You went to Harvard University. I'd like you to help me assemble my papers with a view at Hyde Park, with a view to writing my memoirs." He said, "I'm sure Winston's going to." So Commander Elsey began to pull together the papers. So it was very sad that the president's health really plummeted in late 1944. And then when he died, when he went out, for instance, to meet Stalin the first time, he'd begun keeping a diary. And so there was a lot of actual documentary material, a lot of diaries, other people's diaries and so forth to pull together. It was a lot of work, but it wasn't impossible. Recast that whole dramatic period between 1942 and 1945. The saddest thing is that Winston Churchill, who was a wonderful writer, did survive the war and was determined to write his own account about how he had won it. And so he wrote 6 volumes of memoirs. They were bestsellers in Britain and in America and across the world. It's called, very modestly, The Second World War, but it's basically Winston Churchill's memoirs. And that became, in a sense, the World War II gospel, because obviously nobody had ever been witness to the higher direction of the war in the same way as Winston Churchill. And he'd even stolen most of the government records when he was voted out of office in 1945. So any historian writing today is still sort of writing against the tide, this British tide of Winston Churchill. And on the one hand, you can't help admiring this man for his, extraordinary command of English and just his phrasing and his wit. From the other point of view, it's somewhat tragic because I think Churchill really did history a disservice in minimizing the importance of President Roosevelt in dictating the strategy of the war. And it's saddest of all for me as a historian was to find, not that long ago, a diary entry at the FDR Library by Eisenhower's naval aide, in which the naval aide in his diary in 1943 recorded Winston Churchill boasting that he did not keep a diary, he didn't want to be held to the documentation of an actual diary, he was going to write his own account after the war, and he would, quote, bury his mistakes.
And some critics have said that one of the reasons that perhaps the Prime Minister did this is because he wanted to wait till afterwards so that he could alter left or right, whichever way he needed to write. Is that correct?
Oh, sure, sure. I mean, he'd lost the prime ministership in 1945 in a landslide, and he wanted to get back into office in the early 1950s. So portraying himself as the sort of not only the savior of Europe in 1940, which he was, but also the strategic genius behind the winning of World War II against the Nazis. He was doing this because it would be a tremendous fillip in terms of his getting back into the prime ministership, which, of course, he did.
What about, we don't hear much, and people wonder, I guess, about the relationship between President Roosevelt and Joseph Stalin, and some people wonder, why would we ally ourselves with somebody like Joseph Stalin, knowing his background and everything else that went on?
Well, right from the start, FDR understood that Stalin was basically a psychopath, a mass murderer. But his view was that the people of the United States, and especially Congress, were not willing to go to war with the Soviet Union. Only somebody as crazy as Hitler would dare try doing that, with terrible consequences. So as the war progressed and the Russians took the brunt of the terrible casualties on the Eastern Front, I mean, the Russians were facing two-thirds of the Wehrmacht on the Eastern Front, the president took a very realistic point of view. He wanted to save American life, and he was willing to send lend-lease armaments to Russia, but he was under no illusions about the nature of communism or the ruthlessness of Stalin's dictatorship. And his view was, we'll do our best to treat them as an ally, to work with them as far as we can, but with our eyes open. And we'll try and bring them in as the war reaches its climax and towards its end. We'll try and bring them into a larger notion of post-war peace under a United Nations body. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But at least we will have given them the opportunity.
And of course, the president, as we mentioned, died in office. And so people might wonder, had he lived, what would have been the fate of the atomic bomb?
I'm often asked that. And I have to say, as a historian, I've left that story, the development of the atom bomb and FDR's preparations for its possible use in 1945.
For book three?
Spring of 1945, for book three. I think I can confidently say at this point, but who knows what material may yet turn up, the president would have used it. He was an enormously compassionate man. And to receive the intelligence, the secret intelligence that he did about the atrocities that Japanese were committing across the Pacific, not only against American POWs, but against the peoples that the Japanese had conquered, I don't think the president would have been willing to sacrifice hundreds of thousands more American casualties just to extend the war until the point where the Japanese would willingly surrender without an atomic bomb.
Nigel, we want to thank you so much for taking the time with us. We've had a great history lesson here in the last half hour, and we appreciate your time. Again, we've been visiting with award-winning New York Times bestselling author and historian Nigel Hamilton. The book is Commander-in-Chief, FDR's Battle with Churchill, 1943, and it's book two of a trilogy. Book one is called The Mantle of Command. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Norma Martinez. Our producer is Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.